Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Dylan Roof, the 21-year-old arrested for the massacre of six African-American women and three African-American men last week at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, is being held on $1 million bond. He was charged with 9 counts of murder and 1 count of possession of a weapon to commit a violent crime. Roof faced relatives of those killed in court, some of whom said they forgive him. Preliminary investigations revealed that he shot each of the 9 victims multiple times using his handgun after spending an hour with them in Bible study. Some of the survivors managed to live through the ordeal by playing dead. Over the weekend, news broke that a website maintained by Roof called The Last Rhodesian was discovered. On it, he featured dozens of photos of himself with the Confederate flag and other racist symbols and wrote a manifesto about why he was a racist. As the fallout from the massacre unfolded across the national consciousness, many activists from the Black Lives Matter movement around the country gathered in Detroit last week. One of them is my guest, Malina Abdullah. She is a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA and an organizer with Black Lives Matter LA. Welcome to Uprising, Malina.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, what was it like to be at this retreat when this horrific, historic incident played out? This incident that really ought to be a game-changing massacre in how we view what race and racism is, happening at a time when you and other activists who are attempting to address these types of matters were together in Detroit.
Well, I just think it was really, really necessary. It was so necessary for us to be together and for us to share that space. We don't often talk about what it's like emotionally and spiritually to be dealing with this constantly. And then the horror of the terror that we experienced a few days ago, to be in a space where we could be supportive of one another, where we could hold each other, where we could really kind of be strength for one another so that we can go back out and organize and be strength for other folks was really, really important. And so, of course, we didn't know that the timing was going to be what it was. But it felt important, just the day-to-day organizing that we do, to come together and to kind of hold space with one another. And so for us to be there in such a time of trauma and have each other to hold helped us to kind of process and deal with this, and I think a way that enables us to move forward and kind of lay a framework and a groundwork for how we move forward as a whole, as a larger society and a larger group.
How do you process a massacre like this? I mean, I'm thinking of the 1963 church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, that killed 4 little black girls, and that incident rocked the nation. Do you see what happened in Charleston as on par with that horrific incident? And if so, how does it figure within activism and organizing?
Well, absolutely. Of course, you know, we weren't around then during the church bombings. But something like this, I think, reminds us that we still live in a country that is fundamentally white supremacist, that there is no safe space for black people. Black people are not safe walking home. We're not safe, you know, sleeping on our father's couches. We're not safe even praying in a church. And I think it's a reminder of how absolutely unsafe the society is for black people. And it reminds us that we are in a constant state of assault and a constant state of war. What happened was a terrorist act. And I think it's really important that we frame it that way, that we understand that this was a thought out assault on black people specifically in a space that was symbolic of black strength and resilience. Right. And I think that we need to understand it in those terms.
I mean, some people on social media have said if this was a synagogue and if this was a white supremacist who had killed a number of Jews and who espoused racist anti-Semitic views, we might not hesitate to call it not just a hate crime, but a terrorist act. For example, when the Boston Marathon bombing happened and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who's similar to Dylan Dylan Roof was him and his brother in that case, were individuals who weren't part of an extremist organization but were radicalized online through online propaganda, as Dylan Roof did. Immediately, President Obama said that was a terrorist act. In this case of the church massacre, James Comey, the FBI director, said this was a hate crime, or it's being investigated rather as a hate crime, and that it does not classify as a terrorist act. And he trotted out some justification for President Obama, even though he's spoken out about racism, refuses to use the T word.
Right. I mean, even if we think about the headlines of major newspapers, they keep calling it hate. I think it's really important that we understand that hate is an emotion. Mm-hmm. Hate is not the same thing as terror. What happened, that act, was a terrorist act. And you're right, if it were any other group, it would be undoubtedly called terrorism. So I think that it's also indicative, again, of this larger white supremacist frame, right? That Black people are incapable of being the victims of terror, mm-hmm. right? That terrorism is not enacted upon or exacted upon the lives of Black people because we're used to Black people being less than human and dehumanized. And that's kind of the place that we've occupied in white supremacist imagination. So we need to, that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is about, is recognizing who we are and our own power and our right to life and our right to live and our right to live without terror. And so I think that we need to use our own rhetoric and use our own frame and think about what this means for us. I think we also need to think about what it means in terms of coming out of this and how do we exert our power? How do we continue to rally behind the understanding that Black Lives Matter, and how do we root out terrorism wherever it is, in the individual forms as well as the systemic forms that are starting to unveil themselves in the aftermath of all of this, the way that the mainstream media is covering it, the entire criminal justice system, the protection of Dylan Roof, this kind of desire to understand him rather than understand the victims. I think those things are things that we all need to think about as we move forward.
Melina, a lot of attention has focused in the last couple of days on the symbols of racism in the South and in South Carolina, and that is the Confederate flag in particular, which many people are demanding be taken down. And one state representative, a Republican actually, Doug Brannon, said he will introduce a bill to take it down. Is the fixation on the Confederate flag important, or is it a distraction?
I mean, I think symbols of terror, which is what that is, if we think about what the Confederacy is and what the Confederate flag represents, I think that that's really important. So I do think that it's important that we take
that flag
down.
It would be like having a discussion about the swastika.
Absolutely. And so I think unquestionably we should take that down without question. That said, that should not be our primary focus because it's bigger than a flag, right? So the flag should come down without question. However, we really need to unpack what kind of society we live in that has allowed this flag to wave for all of these years, right? So if we think about being, you know, we just celebrated Juneteenth, the 150th Juneteenth. And so since then, Juneteenth being the day that my people are from Beaumont, Texas, got word that we were actually free from the system of chattel slavery. So since the supposed end of chattel slavery, that Confederate flag has flown freely in most Southern states. And we need to think about what kind of society we live in that continues to fly that symbol. And so that's really the bigger question, not the symbol itself. The symbol needs to come down, but what kind of societal framework we live in that allows it to be flown.
And by the way, Melina, there was vandalism of a Confederate statue in Charleston over the weekend. Someone had spray painted the words in red, Black Lives Matter, and quote, "This is the problem, hashtag racist." And there were also reports of the Confederate flag being burned. What do you make of that?
Well, one, I don't see that as vandalism. I see that as resistance. I see that as a righteous act. And I didn't do it. So I don't want to make it sound like I did it or know who did it. But I do think that folks have the right to combat oppression. That's an oppressive symbol. And so if people are toppling it, we need to think about that. Like, it was celebrated when people toppled the statue of Saddam Hussein, right? Well, for Black people, when we think about what slavery is, what this legacy of chattel slavery, of racist oppression, of continued kind of just day-to-day fear, and fear about what's going to happen to our children when they leave their homes, fear about what happens when our fathers go to a church to pray, right? If we live in a state of that, how can we not resist it with everything that we have? And if all we have is a can of spray paint, then use that. And so I think that that is a righteous act, and that's an act of resistance.
And more news this week, or this morning rather, that the Council of Conservative Citizens was just reported to have given tens of thousands of dollars in political contributions to Republicans. This is the group that is seen as Dylan Roof's gateway into hate, if you will. He cited them on his website. This is the group that fixates on, quote, black on white crime. And they've given lots of money to GOP candidates. Should we be surprised that the GOP is linked to that type of hate? Ted Cruz, by the way, has said that he's going to return the money. And I'm wondering if you think that's too little, too late.
Well, I'm not surprised. That said, I don't. I think that we need to make it a nonpartisan issue. Mm-hmm. There are as many racist Democrats as there are Republicans, and it may come in different forms. But we need to, again, look at the overarching system of white supremacy. We need to come to terms with the fact that Dylan Roof's act was his own act, but it's also a part of a larger system. It's beyond an individual. It's beyond a question of Republicans. It's beyond a question of these small groups. It's really part of our overarching system. It's in our educational system. It's in an educational system that refuses to make ethnic studies a priority. It's in the system of healthcare where Black, even if we take things like infant mortality, the Black infant mortality rate in this country paralleling and being worse in some cases than developing nations. It's in, you know, the system of mass incarceration, and it's in the system of the police murders that plague our communities. And so I think that, yes, it's really important that folks not take money from hate groups, exactly, terror groups. I think it's important that they not take money. But I think it's also important that we think about how this is embedded into every aspect of our society, and how do we then begin to vision a new society, one that doesn't just simply seek to take down flags and say, I'm returning money, but vision a new society where we say, okay, how do we make Black Lives Matter really in a real meaningful way? How do we begin to kind of overturn these systems that keep us oppressed and really keep everyone in chains? Mm-hmm. Because racism binds even those who benefit from it.
Right. And a quick note on police. There was a new Gallup poll that found that confidence in police is the lowest today than it has been since the Rodney King beatings. Finally, Melina, in the retreat that you participated in with members of the Black Lives Matter movement late last week, with this national gathering of activists like yourself, what is the sort of organizing that came out of that? What is the plan, particularly to really have this broad vision, not just have it, you know, we hear about the activism around police violence, but as you just laid out so clearly, this is a much, much bigger struggle, but that also requires a much, much bigger and broader fight then.
Right. So we are really committed to building a mass movement. Next month in Cleveland, there's going to be a gathering of Movement for Black Lives. So the gathering in Detroit was only for Black Lives Matter chapter leads. And we're also talking about how do we ensure that this movement moves forward. People are affected on a really deep level by police violence. And what this retreat helped us to understand and embrace is that that's a jumping off point for visioning a larger solution and for really kind of conceptualizing public safety first in new ways beyond policing, but also kind of doing collective visioning around what kind of society we want to build and also healing ourselves in the process. And so those were the kind of, that was the emphasis of the gathering in Detroit and next month in Cleveland when we come together with folks who are Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. and part of a larger movement for Black Lives. We'll continue the conversation and talk about what different spaces each of us occupy.
Melina Abdullah, thank you so much for joining us and for all the work that you do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melina Abdullah is a professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA. She's an organizer with Black Lives Matter LA.